Zoom, everybody. Okay. This is our Sunday program, conducted a little differently than we're accustomed to conducting our Sunday program. Instead of in the temple, it's done remotely, which is just fine. And the Chicago Temple has been following a pattern of taking chapter by chapter by chapter, Canto 1. And so far, everything has now gotten to chapter 18. So we're going to discuss something from chapter 18. And because this coming week is... What's special about this coming week? World Holy Name Week. World Holy Name Week. So that our whole life is in relation to the Holy Name, but specifically this week is a festival being organized by the by Lokanath Maharaj and his team of devotees to help the whole world membership of ISKCON. Oh, leave it open. Leave it open. Leave it open. Air is good. Unless you're cold. Are you cold? Oh, the air is coming too. Maybe if it cools down or something and you get chilly back there. So back to Srimad Bhagavatam and World Holy Name Festival or World Holy Name Week. And there's a theme for this particular year's. So all over ISKCON, this coming week, you probably know, but India Standard Time, four programs every evening, different speakers conducting classes and so forth. So if you don't know, you can find out how to connect with a wonderful cast of speakers for developing an understanding of how to benefit, how to help ourselves strengthen our Krishna consciousness through the chanting of the Holy Name. And the theme this year is make the world fortunate. And it's really easy to understand how that theme came about because I'll tell a little story, a Prabhupada story, about making people fortunate. In 1970 something, probably 72, maybe 73, a few years ago, Srila Prabhupada was visiting us in New York, and in the course of one of the morning classes, he was describing his relationship with Bhakti Siddhanta. And he was speaking with profound humility and with very genuine emotion, saying, my spiritual master found me in some dark place. And by his mercy, he made me fortunate. And his voice was a little choked and became emotional and, Jai Prabhupada. And then he instructed me, you go forward and you make others fortunate. And so I have come to your country to make you all fortunate. Jai Prabhupada. And then he passed the baton to us and said, and now I'm instructing all of you. You take this good fortune and you make the lives of others fortunate. So we weren't going to say no. We could say we're not qualified, but it was Jai Prabhupada. So how does an unfortunate person make people fortunate? How does an unfortunate person make people fortunate? Well, you can't. But you can be an instrument of the one who's fortunate and pass on fortune to others, the fortune of the fortunate, who receive fortune from the fortunate and so forth. We can act as an instrument of the cyclic succession and just distribute that good fortune. And the good fortune comes specifically in this age of Kali in a particular feature. That's the form of Krishna within his holy name. The form of Krishna makes others fortunate. Like one of the questions early in the first canto of Srimad Bhagavatam, the first chapter of first canto Bhagavatam, the sages of Naimisharanya want to know from Suta Goswami, when Krishna was present walking upon the earth, just the touch of his lotus feet upon the earth made the earth so fortunate. Everything was bountiful. The disturbances on the planet, Krishna dismissed them by his great power. But now Krishna's gone. So what will make people, where will religious principles take shelter now? And the answer given is in Srimad Bhagavatam. Of course, in Srimad Bhagavatam means also within the pages of Srimad Bhagavatam, there's enormous emphasis, beginning, literally, beginning to end and in the middle, emphasis on the Yuga Dharma. The Yuga Dharma is the chanting of the holy name, right? Is that right? Yeah, okay. Yuga Dharma. Yuga means the age and Dharma means activity that connects one with the Supreme. Yuga Dharma for this age is the chanting of the holy name. So we find in chapter 18 of Canto 1 and other chapters within Canto 1 and throughout, laced throughout as a theme, the importance of chanting the holy name. And the person who speaks in chapter 18 is Suta Goswami. And Suta Goswami is being asked a series of questions which he responds to in chapter 18. And the persons asking the questions are the sages. The sages, they're all brahmanas, headed by Shaunaka, who is a disciple of Bhrigu. And amongst the most learned persons, we're just reading a text in Srimad Bhagavatam, where Valmiki and Bhrigu are especially learned. They're esteemed for their capacity. Now, Valmiki wasn't born a brahmana. In fact, quite to the opposite end of the spectrum. Of course, it depends on which Ramayana you read, but born a dacoit, or lived his life at least as a dacoit. That's one of the common renderings of Valmiki before he became Valmiki. Other renderings within the Bhagavatam, he's the son of Varuna, but how that happened was he was within this anthill, and Varuna came along and washed away the anthill, and there was Valmiki, or Ratnakar, depending on the version that you receive, and he then gave him the name, born from an anthill. So, Shaunaka, is a son of Bhrigu, like Valmiki, vastly learned. He was the eldest and leading persons amongst the sages, and they're brahmanas. But the person that they're hearing from is Sutta. And Sutta, by Vedic culture standards, was not born in high birth. In fact, he was born in a pratiloma birth. That is, his mother was higher than his father as far as their social position is concerned. But so Rama Harshan, his father, was respected by Vyasadeva enough that Vyasadeva entrusted him when he divided and compiled the Vedas. He entrusted him with all the Puranic portion of the literatures of the Vedas. And then he in turn taught his son Sutta. So Sutta, by material standards, his birth was not a high birth. And yet he's being honored by the sages who are Brahman by birth. They're placing him in the elevated seat and posing questions for him to respond. That's how, there's details, lots of details. The whole story of Maharishi Parikshit has been told. We spent some time discussing, actually, you know, the age of Kali and the advent of the age of Kali and so forth. So it's a bad age where persons, as we know, from various angles, persons in this age of Kali are born into an unfortunate circumstance because the age is manda, very bad. Manda samanda matayo manda bhagya hyupadrata. It's a very unfortunate circumstance. And Sutta's circumstance was similarly unfortunate in the sense of his material situation. So just to go into it a little bit, those who are twice born are considered twice born because they, one of the requirements for the twice born is that they observe the purificatory processes. They're called samskaras. And there's a number of them. And the samskaras, the first of them is the samskara prior to conception. And so the point, without going into much of the detail, in this age of Kali, persons rarely, hardly ever, observe Garbhadhan Sangskara, the purificatory procedure prior to conception. Therefore, by birth, having not undergone that purificatory process, by birth one is not Brahmana. One is not qualified Dvija Bandhu, the son of a twice born. One's mother and father are twice born. Without sangskaras, it's not what brahmanas are made of. So everyone, in this age of Kali, generally speaking, that's not observed. And so persons are not in that dvija category, brahmanas, kshatriyas, or vaishyas. Everyone is in the Sudra or lower category, by birth. So this is this age of Kali. And how to make the unfortunate fortunate. That's the theme of the World Holy Name Week. And here we have it in the verses of this 18th chapter, where Sutta Goswami is being asked questions by these very elevated, highly learned Brahmins. And he's feeling a little overwhelmed. You're most qualified and you're presenting questions to me. And how has he gotten that position? By being made fortunate. And there's two mentions of how he's made fortunate. He's made fortunate by association of the fortunate. And he's made fortunate by the chanting of the holy name. Because the chanting of the holy name is the means of, in this age of Kali in particular, but at any time, to eradicate the reactions to one's past misdeeds that result in misfortune. We're the architects of our good fortune and ill fortune. That's taught in Bhagavad Gita. Sadasad yoni janmasu. Nice verse from Bhagavad Gita. Purushak prakriti stohi bhunkte prakriti jan gunan karanam gunasangosya sad asad yoni janmasu. Sad asad, good fortune, ill fortune. We're the architects. We're responsible for good fortune, ill fortune. We're not meant to be the enjoyers of the good fortune or the sufferers of the ill fortune. We're meant to go beyond good fortune, ill fortune. That's the teaching of Bhagavad Gita. Go beyond elevation to a higher position in the heavenly realm or even up to Brahmaloka. We're advised in Bhagavad Gita like that. To go beyond the limits of bad fortune, especially in this age of Kali, it's good association and the holy name. Now, finding good association that can carry you beyond misfortune, that's not easy. Sadhu Sangha is that good association. And where's the genuine, not just the saffron dress and the long beard and so forth, sadhu, but where's the quality where it's really sadhu? And sadhu means a genuine devotee, when those who are very elevated in their spiritual path to attain the supreme. That's really what sadhu is. Not just learned, but spiritually elevated in their journey back home, back to Godhead. So Sutta Goswami is saying, I'll read the verse, but I'll describe first. This good fortune that has come my way, that has changed my misfortune, is the association of saintly people. So it's for that reason I'm nothing special. I'm an unfortunate person, but I've been made fortunate by these elevated personalities. And I've been made fortunate by the chanting of the holy name, or those who are engaged in the chanting of the holy name. So I'm going to read these two verses from Canto 1, Chapter 18, Texts 18 and 19. 1, 18, 18 and 19. So Sutta has been asked many questions, and he's now responding. And he's turning his attention to Krishna. He's spoken to by the sages, and he's turning his attention to Krishna. O God, although we are born in a mixed caste, we are still promoted in birthright simply by serving and following the great who are advanced in knowledge. Even by conversing with such great souls, one can without delay cleanse oneself of all disqualification resulting from lower births. Misfortune can be changed to good fortune by Sadhu Sangha. And then he says, and what to speak of those who are under the direction of the great devotees chanting the holy name of the unlimited, who has unlimited potency, the personality of Godhead, unlimited in potency and transcendental by attributes, is called the Ananta, the unlimited. So the unlimited has unlimited potency. This is an important and very basic understanding of Bhagavan or God. So I'll just say it again in a different way, but it's the same thing. Jiva Goswami explains in his Bhagavat Sandarbha, very simple principle, and the whole of the Sandarbha is expanding on this principle. And that is, in order to understand God, or say it negatively, it's not possible to understand God if one does not accept that he has unlimited and inconceivable potencies. We'll say it positively. One can understand God to the degree that one is able to understand he has unlimited and inconceivable potencies. If you say, no, he can't do this or he can't do that, then he's not unlimited. I heard Prabhupada tell a story, then more recently I heard it's a philosophical paradox. So the story is Prabhupada was explaining that one time he was asked, Swamiji, can God create a stone or an object so heavy he cannot lift it? It's a trick question. Because if you say, yes, he can create something that's so heavy he can't lift it, there's something he can't do. Or if you say, no, he can't create something so heavy he can't lift it, there's something he can't do. So he's not unlimited. It's a trick question. So Prabhupada said, I answered, yes, he can create something that's so heavy he can't lift it and then lift it. And very recently I heard this is a European, it's called the stone paradox, something like that. Exactly the same, you know. So the absolute is unlimitedly unlimited. He cannot do and then do things he cannot do. There's a nice example of this during Krishna's childhood pastimes. Sometimes there's this quachit. Sometimes the gopis, the elder gopis, would ask Krishna to pick up something. Like that nice example, Mother Yashoda would ask Krishna to pick up Nanda Maharaja's shoes. And he'd very happily toddle over and put the shoes on his head and toddle back and smile, standing before Nanda Maharaj. And who can imagine what Nanda Maharaj was feeling and Mother Yashoda was feeling and Krishna was feeling? He's the personality of Godhead. But they don't see him like that. They see him as their darling little boy. And sometimes they would say to pick up something that he couldn't pick up. So he would go over to that something and just point at it, touch it, and smile. Like, you know, he didn't say, he couldn't even talk yet, but you know, couldn't say, I can't pick it up, it's too heavy. But he could understand. And then he lifts Govardhan Hill. Who can lift a hill? It's something he created. And he can not lift it and lift it. He doesn't even need to lift it to lift it. He doesn't even need to say it's some magic mantra and the hill levitates. He can just will something and it happens. He's unlimited. And similarly, within the names of the unlimited, there's unlimited potency. Nija Sarva Shaktis, that's Lord Chaitanya's teaching. Nija means his own. Sarva Shaktis is all of his potencies, and that's a lot of potency, are in each and every one of his names. So one who is engaged in chanting his names, that which is misfortune becomes fortunate. I just spent today, I think I can share this, I just spent a 2.5-hour Zoom call with a very learned devotee who was explaining one of the chapters of Srimad Bhagavatam, Uddhava Gita, where Uddhava is asking Krishna to explain about deity worship. It's very elaborate. And then switching over to Hari Bhakti Vilas and what it says about deity worship and Hari Bhakti Vilas. And it's like, it's a voluminous book written by Sanatan Goswami or compiled by Gopal Bhatta and written in its published form by Sanatan Goswami. Very, very elaborate descriptions. And of course, in all of that description, it's not just deity worship. It's also, that's a form of the Lord that's accessible for those who are seeking connection with the source of everything in this age through deity worship. But the most accessible form of approaching the Supreme Lord is through the holy name. And there, with deity worship, there's prior qualification and so many rules. Specifically, I mean, he was making a big point about this. Worship of deity requires second initiation, certainly in our temples. But, you know, Hari Bhakti Vilas doesn't just say in temples. Now, it's very common practice in the world of ISKCON and outside the world of ISKCON, that people will go to purchase deities in a marketplace where they make deities and take the deity home. Then they may even have an installation ceremony by some priest or something. But Hari Bhakti Vilas is specifying by the twice born. Now, many people don't do that. And there's different reasons why people don't do that. But the most important thing is the chanting of the holy name. And the chanting of the holy name doesn't make one twice born. It makes one better than twice born, but it helps to qualify one to receive mantras through which one worships the deity. Because the deity worship is approached through mantra. I mean, that's Hari Bhakti Vilas. That's the teaching. So one should be eager to follow what Sanatan and Gopal Bhatta Goswami say, which is similar to what Krishna is saying to Uddhava in Uddhava Gita about deity worship. But anyone can chant the holy name. There's no prior niyamatak smarane nikala. There's no niyamas, no rules and regulations, no hard and fast rules, is Prabhupada's translation of Shikshastaka, number one. No hard and fast rules. And so anyone can chant, and even if imperfectly performed chanting, Namabhas is very powerful. Just a reflection of the holy name is very powerful. And then it helps qualify one to become freed from the misfortune, instead become fortunate in this age of Kali, that's an age of misfortune. Manda, Samanda, Mateo. Let me read the purport where Prabhupada is explaining this particular verse that Sutta Goswami is speaking. The Dvijabandhu, or less intelligent, uncultured men, born of higher castes, put forward many arguments against lower class men becoming brahmanas in this life. They argue that birth in a family of shudras or less than shudras is made possible by one's previous sinful acts, and that one therefore has to complete the terms of disadvantages due to lower birth. To answer these false logicians, Srimad Bhagavatam asserts that one who chants the holy name of the Lord under the direction of a pure devotee can at once get free from the disadvantages due to a lower caste birth, which is the case of Sutta, and is the case of persons born in the age of Kali, according to scripture, everyone. Almost everyone. By and large, everyone. Some exceptions, but otherwise, everyone. By the messages already described. The sanskaras are not performed. And so One doesn't have that by birth qualification. It's very significant for those who are meticulous in observing the rules of Brahminical culture. That's one that you can't overlook. None of them can you overlook. Prabhupada speaks about the 10 offenses. To chant the holy name under the direction of a pure devotee is offenseless chanting. Offenseless chanting of the holy name of the Lord is transcendental, and therefore such chanting can at once purify one from the effects of all kinds of previous sins. The offenseless chanting indicates that one has fully understood the transcendental nature of the holy name and has thus surrendered unto the Lord. Transcendentally, the holy name of the Lord and the Lord himself are identical, being absolute. The holy name of the Lord is as powerful as the Lord. The Lord is all-powerful, personality Godhead, and he has innumerable names which are non-different from him and are equally powerful also. The last word of Bhagavad Gita asserts that one who surrenders fully unto him is protected from all sins by the grace of the Lord. Since his name and he himself are identical, the holy name of the Lord can protect the devotee from all effects of sins. So it goes on. Making the unfortunate fortunate. We'll go back to that. I mean, it was a very memorable, it's so many years ago, whatever the number is, nearly 50 years ago. Prabhupada speaking like that, it's still resonating. I was unfortunate. My spiritual master found me in a dark place, and he forced me to open eyes, and he made me fortunate. And then he instructed me. So we're being instructed to become fortunate and to make others fortunate. But again, well, who are we to make others fortunate? Just receive and transmit that which is given to you. And it's such an easy thing to chant. Anyone can do, regardless of anything. No material pre-qualification necessary. All other Vedic processes have some pre-qualification necessary. And chanting of the holy name, it doesn't have. And it's all benedictory, all-powerful. And it can change our fortune. Combine that with sadhu sangha. And one of the best ways to get sadhu sangha, is to put the words of a pure devotee in the center of sadhu sangha. Along with kirtan, of course, the sadhu sangha retreat that's held every year, except this year because of the pandemic, is come together and chant the holy name of the Lord together. That's one form of sadhu sangha. And then this other that Sutta Goswami has experienced is hearing from Shukadev Goswami, hearing from his father, hearing the messages of transcendence, having realized. That's one of the things that's spoken of about Sutta in the very beginning, in chapter 1 of Canto 1. He not only heard, but he understood. He not only understood, but he realized. He not only realized, but he can explain it. Do you know some people that have really, they're really good at something and they're really terrible at explaining it? I've had some experience with that. Really elevated persons. They really know their stuff. And when it comes to teaching it, they're just like, it's not a gift that's been given to them. There's anecdotal memories as I'm speaking this. Really, really gifted devotees. People. So, Sutta had all those qualifications. And how did he get them? Well, how does one get anything? You get from the source of everything, ultimately. was listening to Prabhupada explaining yad yad acharati shrestas tat tat eve tororjana, where he was explaining to a really new 22nd Avenue young Western people audience. Like, you know, they knew nothing about nothing. And so he was explaining that everyone has to accept a leader. And he was giving examples. Even in animal society, bird society, you know, they come together, the pigeons come together, they don't go with the crows. And the crows come together, they don't go with the ducks. And ducks go together, they don't go with the swans. And birds of a feather flock together. But even when there's a group, there's always a leader. After hearing that, I was watching the flock of geese flying in the sky. And they were just going in circles. But, you know, they're all following the leader. There must have been some reason for why they were going in circles, but they're following the leader. Anyway, his point was, it's natural. And so where does one get the ability to be a leader? In society, there are people that follow this group or that group, and there's always, whatever group, there's a leader. So that leader comes from an empowerment to be a leader. So why not just follow the leader of leaders? That was Prabhupada's argument. Why not take that opportunity? It's being the invitation from Krishna is there. Just follow him. He's the leader of leaders. And by following the leader of leaders, no more birth in this world. Who would say no? No more old age, no more disease, no more death. You can go ahead and pay your doctor bills and, you know, etc. Or you can have no more doctor bills and no more disease, no more death, no more any difficulties like that. By taking the principle that's universal, follow leaders and follow the supreme leader. Misfortune becomes good fortune. So how are people in this age of Kali to do that? And these same two things spoken by Sutta in this chapter, Sadhu Sangha and Nam Sankirtan, the presence of the Lord, easily accessible to anyone, everyone, no disqualification or that bars you, no prior qualification needed. Chant the holy name. Of course, as one chants the holy name, there are some conditions to get the full benefit, and that's don't make offense. So we learn what are the offenses and try to avoid the offenses and try to serve, not just for the sake of liberation, of getting free from unwanted things, but gradually as one progresses to come to the position where one just wants to be the servant of the master of all masters, the Lord of all lords, the supreme, the Ananta, the unlimited, all-powerful Supreme, and just to be in the service of the Supreme, and chanting in that mood. Well, it's not easy to always chant in that mood because of our contaminations. Try it. It's not easy to always chant in that mood. But if we continue to try to be in service to the name, then this offenseless chanting can come, and one can be transported more swiftly than any other method found within the Vedas or anywhere. There's this chanting of the holy name in the, particularly one more time, in the association of sadhus. And sadhu in one sense simply means the devotees. They're becoming purified. Those are the sadhus. Those who are mature in that purified state, that's especially valuable. But that's also an endowment or a gift from the personality of Godhead. So they've received by Sadhu Sangha and Nam Sankirtan. So that's our topic for this evening. Make the world fortunate through the chanting of the holy name, the World Holy Name Festival, and trying to connect that with the sequencing of the Sunday theme at the Chicago Temple, this being the week for Canto 1, Chapter 18. So let's see if there's some discussion. I know there's devotees here that are really good at asking probing questions. So let's see if we can get some discussion going. You have anything today? You'll think about it. Think about it and we'll come back to you. He's usually the first one with his hand up. Okay. Comments or questions, anybody? We have some online ones already? Okay. We'll do the one question.
This question is from Kamar Bazarek. What to do with the deities that I have on my altar at home? I haven't had Diksha initiation yet, and also my huge Tulsi Maharani.
That's a nice question. It was discussed in this 2.5 hour conversation today. such persons, you and such persons, should understand, you can go on with your deity worship, and you should understand what Sanatan Goswami is providing in Hari Bhakti Vilas. Now, that is, may you soon come to the position of following the standard given in Hari Bhakti Vilas. Now, the standards of worship of deity in the home is not the same as the standard of worship of deity in the temple. At the same time, the principle, it doesn't say that in Hari Bhakti Vilas. Home worship, shrug your shoulders, deity worship, no, it's strict. It doesn't say that in Hari Bhakti Vilas. But the standards for deity worship in home are more relaxed, but not specifically this one. So I don't want to overemphasize. I don't want anyone to become uncomfortable or feel guilty or you're in a penalty box or something like that. But understand what our acharyas are teaching us based on scripture and come to that stage. Don't be in anxiety and don't offend your deities and don't do something rash and foolish, but understand this is what our acharyas are teaching and strive. Because the purpose of deity worship is to fix your mind on the Lord, and the standards of deity worship are not the same as chanting the holy name. So the teaching that Prabhupada gave us even in our temples was initially pictures. And I know some devotees who are Brahminically initiated and they still have pictures. I know some devotees that are not initiated and they have deities. So the standard is not well known. The standard is not carefully followed. But there is a standard and we should strive to come to that stage where we meet the standard. That's my advice. As far as Tulsi, there's no restriction. You don't have to be anything. You can be a gardener and take care of Tulsi. Do you take care of Tulsi at home? Yes? You water Tulsi. How often do you water Tulsi? Every day? Every day? Almost every day. Okay. You brush your teeth every day. And you water Tulsi almost every day. Okay. So he's got a question. We ought to give him the microphone.
What is the relationship between Tulsi and Krishna?
What's the relationship between who and Krishna?
Tulsi.
Tulsi and Krishna. Tulsi and Krishna? That's your question? Tulsi, that's a nice question. Tulsi is a very dear devotee. And because Tulsi has the power to give bhakti, because she, devotees can give bhakti. And Tulsi could not only give bhakti, but bhakti as it's found in Vrindavan, and even bhakti as it's found amongst the elevated gopis. So the relationship between Tulsi and Krishna is she's very dear to Krishna. And Krishna holds her very dear. That's the relationship. She's a special devotee, Tulsi Devi. It's said in deity worship teachings that when articles are offered, when food items, bhoga, is offered to Krishna, it must be offered with tulsi. So some people don't have tulsi in their home, but they want to offer it to Krishna, so you can offer to Krishna. But Krishna is especially pleased and accepts offerings, especially likes the offerings made when offered with tulsi leaves. Do you do that too? Do you help pick the tulsi leaves sometimes? Yeah? There's times when to pick tulsi and procedures. That's nice to learn too. But for now, you can probably just do it. But in time, you can learn. There's some procedures. Ask some tulsi pujaris. They'll teach you. Okay?
Hare Krishna Guru Maharaj. So today I was listening to a Prabhupada lecture with my mom. And Prabhupada said that if you're asking help for Krishna for sense gratification, it's still Maya. But then other people have also told me that I should, whenever I feel like I need help, I should ask Krishna if that's even materially or spiritually.
Yeah.
So my question is, I'm a little confused on which side I should go with.
Ask. It according to Bhagavad Gita, and Prabhupada would refer to this verse, four types of pious people render devotional service unto me. And almost all people of this world want something. And Krishna is the source of everything. So rather than going to over here or over there or over there, or just relying upon your own capacity, you go to Krishna for that something. But it's mixed devotion. It's not, you're in Maya. It's not like that. You're in bhakti. But, you know, it's preliminary bhakti. And so, by going to Krishna for something, then you are helping to establish a relationship with Krishna that's, you know, it's kind of mercantile. I do this and you do that. Thank you very much, Krishna. But one can go beyond that standard. But for the initial stage, you go to Krishna. Go to Krishna. And then strengthen the devotional element, not just the bartering element. Or, I'm in need, please help me out. He'll be happy to help you out. He'll help you out even if you don't. But if you go to him, he'll be happier to help you than if you don't. Just like, you know, your relationships in your family. Your mother's going to help you out, you know, whether you ask it or not. And if you ask, then she's happy to help you out. More happy. That's the relationship. That's the relationship in your family. And so it's, you know, you strengthen the relationship. And then after some time, you know, the little light goes on and says, gee, maybe I should do something for mom. And, you know, that's love. That's the relationship with Krishna is like that. It's then I don't need to ask Krishna for something to go to Krishna. I'm so grateful that Krishna has given so much. Okay, back in the back row. Take the microphone in the front row and then pass it back. Thanks.
Hare Krishna Guru Maharaj. In Purushottam month and Kartik month, Is there any similarity, or which is more powerful, or
which is more powerful? They're both more powerful. How's that? My understanding is that Damodar month is especially powerful for a variety of reasons. And Purushottam month doesn't come as often as the Damodar month. But when it comes, take advantage. And it doesn't so much matter which one is more powerful. And the advantage is connecting with your mission of life and taking some vow that will strengthen your determination and focus on achieving the goal of life. So microphone, come back this way. You have more. You have more?
Maharaji, in your discussion with that Prabhu regarding deity worship, does Gauranitai worship discussion came? Is that okay for devotees who are not Brahminically initiated?
Well, you know, if you ask this devotee that I spoke to, he'll say no. And I didn't get into a thing with him. I know that Prabhupada was particularly liberal with Gauranitai deities. But Hari Bhakti Vilas says. So that may help. So those who wish to do deity worship should understand the mercy of Prabhupada, and over there on the other side of the pan scale is Hari Bhakti Vilas. It says I should have this second initiation, dvija, because the deity is approached through mantra. And mantra is given at diksha. And so Maha Mantra you can chant and worship your Gauranitai deities and understand what Hari Bhakti Vilas says on the one hand and on the other hand. So I'm a little more balanced than this Prabhu. But, you know, what he's speaking is scripture.
Question from Anand Prabhu. Thank you for sharing your wonderful faith in how Krishna and His holy name is unlimitedly and inconceivably potent. Now, there are times where fulfillment of our needs may depend on other people, and other people might not be cooperative, might even be unreasonably non-cooperative. Where do we draw the line between making practical efforts to deal with it and just leave it and depend on Krishna to make arrangements if he desires so?
That requires intelligence and understanding time, place, circumstance. Ultimately, we're not dependent on other people, ultimately dependent upon Krishna. Now, all of this gets into time, place, circumstance kind of considerations. There's not a cookie cutter answer to this kind of a question. One requires intelligence to discern what's appropriate in this particular time, place, circumstance. And not in any case should your attention, my attention or your attention or anyone's attention go away from who we're ultimately dependent upon. Yena tena pakarena manak krishna navesha yet, where our attention should always go to Krishna. And, you know, one of the biggest risks in understanding what to do about situation XYZ is we get into problem solving, and if we forget who we are, if we get the purpose of life, if we get Krishna, we just get sucked into Maya and the problem and trying to solve a problem. So that's not a good mistake to make. Better to err on the side of caution and stay, so trying to be responsive to the question, stay on the side of relying upon Krishna. That's not a mistake. That's the better path. If you're not clear, stay there
Question from Vishalaksha Prabhu. What are the steps shall I take to avoid carefully the 10 offenses while chanting the holy name of Lord Krishna?
Two things. Know what the offenses are and avoid them. And most importantly, the second, strive to always remain attentive, because the root of the other offenses is inattentiveness. So go for the high road and watch out for the low road. In short. And be conscious. As you're chanting, be conscious of what you're doing. Because otherwise the lower tendencies will take over.
It's not a question, it's an appreciation comment from Amara Mataji. Today at a grocery shop, the shopkeeper saw our tilak on our head, and he understood that we were from Prabhupada's movement. He voluntarily gave an item for very less price and said, I never respect. Those who take God's names, they are sincere people. So thank you for guiding us on this path, Maharaj.
Thank the shopkeeper. Because even that appreciation for those who chant the holy name, which is exactly what Sutta was saying, then what to speak of being guided by those who chant the holy name, but having that regard for those who chant the holy name. That's it. Very valuable spiritual assets in life. Okay.
Is there a difference in worshipping the deity form of Tulsi Devi versus having her plant form on the altar? I have seen some temple altars have the deity, and some home altars have the deity but not Tulsi in the plant form.
We're going to allow this young man to answer that question. You understand the question? Some persons have a deity form or picture form or something of Tulsi Devi, of Vrinda Devi. I'm speaking to you. And then some people have on their altar a Tulsi plant. So the question is there some difference? And yeah, there's some difference. You can't pick the leaves from the deity and offer it to Krishna on the altar, or when you make your offerings, or a picture or a photograph of Vrinda Devi. So spiritually, there's a oneness and there's also a difference. Now, you can, a very simple solution is grow Tulsi and have the deity or a photograph or painting of Vrinda Devi and Tulsi leaves. But you offer Tulsi leaves. That's recommended. So it depends on your lifestyle and so many other things, but that's ideal. That's preferred. Okay?
Question from Mahati Mataji. What is the difference between installed deities and not installed deities?
There's no, this devotee that I was speaking with today says that's a misnomer. Uninstalled deities is a misnomer. It's not deity. It's dolls. That's his statement. So, deity means it's a form of the Lord, and you invite consciously, and the Lord accepts your invitation to receive your worship. It's not something, you just make up or go to a shop and buy something and stick it on your shelf or something like that. Krishna's not obliged. Krishna's not there. The there is by invitation, by consciousness, not by mechanics. So that's his position. And the procedure of installing deities is very simple. There's elaborate and there's very simple. This is from our head pujari in Mayapur. You know where Mayapur is? You know where Mayapur is? Where Lord Chaitanya appeared? Yeah, it's a place in India. It's where Lord Chaitanya appeared. You know who is Lord Chaitanya? It's where Lord Chaitanya appeared, is Mayapur. So there's the head pujari is named Jananivas. I had some discussion about this not installed deities, and he had a similar, there's no such thing, answer. And he said installation is very simple. It can be as simple as perform Abhishek, dress the deity in new clothing, offer bhoga, and perform arti. Installed. Now, of course, with the intention, because the intention of the worshiper is of utmost importance, but it can be that simple. Installed. Anything further? Anything else in the room? Yes, I thought so.
Hare Krishna Guru Maharaj. This question is about the free will, Guru Maharaj, the free will which we have, right? I compare this with the train track versus we drive the car on the road. When something Krishna plans, it's like a train track, so it reaches the destination correctly. So the point here is like, with our free will, sometimes we make mistake. Krishna gives this free will. And how to even surrender that free will also to Krishna?
How to surrender the free will to Krishna? Yes. Follow his instructions. You have a daughter, right? Yeah. So she has free will, right? She's got free will. Not only that, you're soon going to be, are you a teenager yet? How old are you? 10. So wait till she turns 13. Then you really find free will. And she's going to start, you know, deciding things as in that transition stage from the child to a youth to adult. So, you know, the surrender of free will is called love. And it's not like you lose your free will, but you submit your free will to the object of love. We were discussing in class this morning. Did you hear the class this morning? Remotely? Okay. Here's a Nectar Devotion class, mini. Within the science of bhakti rasa, loving relationships with Krishna, there's different parts, and one of those different parts is there's alambana and udipana. Those are Sanskrit terms. It's nice to know Sanskrit terms. You don't even know what's that, so you're learning something new. Alambana has two parts, the abode of love, ashraya, and the object of love, vishaya. So it's voluntary, there's free will in both directions. The abode of love and the object of love. And there's a relationship in that abode of love and the object of love. So the loving relationship is where love is dedicated to the object of love. And it doesn't have to be the personality of God. It can be in any relationship. But to be rasa, bhakti rasa, then it has to involve the personality of Godhead. So let's just say, you know, you and your daughter. I hope you don't mind me picking on you like this. But, you know, you love your daughter and you know that she has free will. And between the two of you, there's Krishna, who you're both, you know, consciously or not, you're both subservient to. He's the leader. Now you're the father and she's the daughter, and one day she's going to grow up and become a young adult, and she'll make her own decisions. But then still there's Krishna, that the leader that you're both submitting to. Your life is going to change, her life is going to change, and that part, Krishna being, you know, the object of love. So the surrendering your free will and her free will, is consummated or made perfect by making that connection with Krishna. The things may change otherwise, but that doesn't change. The nature and the flavor of that relationship with Krishna, and then in turn the relationship between father and daughter, or husband and wife, or friend and friend, or whatever and whatever. There's dynamics in all of those things, but there's the constant that makes it bhakti rasa, where your will is surrendered or directed to Krishna. Krishna's at the center in all things, in the workplace, in the home, in the marketplace, in your temple, in your deity room, you know, wherever you are. There's one thing that's constant, and that's focusing upon Krishna. That's what it looks like. It's going to be a little different for each of us, but the principle is dedication, making choice where Krishna is at the center of that choice. Pleasing Krishna is at the center of that choice. Okay?
Thank you, Guru.
Okay.
Hare Krishna, Guru Maharaj. My question is, like, if someone is not initiated and still practicing Krishna consciousness,
okay,
and wants to do, in home, they want to do the deity worship, so is it permitted?
We went through this. Such person should be encouraged. I'm just repeating what I heard today for 2.5 hours. Such person should be encouraged to come to the stage where they are second initiated. Now, doesn't say they cannot, doesn't say they should not. It just says, you know, that aspiration should be connected with another aspiration. So, can they? Sure they can. It goes out all over the place. You know, this particular devotee may, like, be flailing his arms and saying, wait a minute, I'm blowing the whistle, saying, you know, you're out of bounds. You're not following Hari Bhakti Vilas. Follow Hari Bhakti Vilas, Prabhu. I mean, that's not his tone, but he wants to encourage people to come to that stage where they're following Hari Bhakti Vilas, because that's our guidelines. And, you know, guidelines means it's from a little more detail. There's sections of the Vedas that deal specifically with deity worship, and it's Vaidika. And then there's another section that's the Agamas, that's also Vedic, and it's for persons who are following the Panchratrika system, which is us. Our system is a combination, it's a little technical, of Vedic and the Agamas. So, like, for example, chanting Purusha Sukta. In our line, chanting a Purusha Sukta is common amongst Vaishnavas. That's a Vedic procedure. And the Purusha Suktas are the Rig Veda mantras. They're to be chanted by Brahmanas, or those that are being trained to become Brahmanas. So we do that along with other things that are in this other section. So it's in order to have deity worship effective, the sentiment is necessary. Has to be there, and procedures have to be there. With the chanting of the holy name, the procedures don't have to be there. Nirma taksmaranika. So, if you want to do, you or someone that you described wants to, then let me become qualified. So, is it doable? Yes, it's doable. And, just adding the and, emphasis. You know, strive to follow the Agamas or the Panchatrika system or the The Hari Bhakti Vilas is the summary of all those things. It says right in the beginning, that's what this is. This is a statement from these sources. By our authority, Sanatana Goswami and Gopal Bhatta Goswami. This is how we are being guided. So strive to come to that stage, such a person you described. And yes, they can. And especially they should, because that's easier. The other is, you know, not as easy. Strive to become qualified.
Thank you, Guru Maharaj.
Okay, yes.
Hare Krishna Maharaji. So my question is about this month only. So Purushottam month. So I was not knowing much about this month, and I was just hearing from some devotees like videos that what to do and the importance of this month. So everywhere, like I was listening that Jagannath Ashtakam is recommended. We should listen in this month or recite. So is there any story behind it, or like it's just?
I should probably spend a couple few hours researching, but right off, I haven't done that. And its main purpose is adjusting the calendar, because the Vedic calendar is a combination of solar and lunar. The solar calendar has no such adjustment. The lunar calendar has no such adjustment. The Vedic calendar is adjusting the solar and the lunar calendar. And that's what we're following. And this is an adjustment month. Without the technical of, you know, what's all that adjustment thing about? It's technical and it's a little complicated. So, but there's auspiciousness in that month because of that adjustment of the Vedic calendar and is following the authorities. And there's probably, you know, a variety and maybe even an abundance of, you know, Puranic stories connected with the month and so forth. Prabhupada didn't teach us those things. And, you know, I'm more interested in things that Prabhupada taught us, so I haven't really gone to find out what's the Puranic story about Purushottam month. But you can go listen to YouTube channels and find out X, Y, Z different things and get a little confused.
Yes, right. So I was thinking, like in Damodar month, like because it was related with Damodar Riza, right?
That's easy.
Yeah, it's the same thing. I was, what is there?
No, Purushottam month is not like that. Damodar month is very, very, very clear. Yeah. And then you're like, back to her question. The Damodar month is special.
Yes.
And the other is, you know, it's more pragmatic than it is otherwise. But you know, it's special, so we do something.
Thank you, Maharaj.
Okay. How about you? You got any? No, you, not your son, you. Anything? Okay. We're done. Yes? Thank you very much, Prabhupada Ki. Thank you.